Hello, John. Welcome.
Hi.
Gosh, you know, I cannot remember a time when I was hungrier for live music. And this is coming from someone who made his career on recorded music. It's just been extraordinary. And I cannot imagine what it's like for your good self not to stand in front of an orchestra and feel that that wonderful compact between you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very up and down. You know, the first few weeks, one was stoic and to sort of get on with preparing things for future concerts, which hadn't been cancelled. But then, of course, as the list of cancellations grows and the date for getting back to work gets moved further and further away, it's difficult to sort of keep your bearings. But we're all in it together. We're all in the same boat, so what else can you do other than just sort of stay calm and try and hope for the best?
Yeah, I was talking to our mutual friend, my dear friend and collaborator, Patricia Routledge, the other day, and I said, you know, this must feel a bit like the war years. And she said, oh, no, she said, not at all. She said, in the war years, we got on with our lives. We were able to just carry on and work. And of course, you don't think of it in those terms. And we have all the communication sophistication now. But she was adamant, this is far worse. How are you using your time, John? I gather you're doing some teaching for a start.
Well, I'm doing, you know, bits of sort of online coaching on Zoom, and if people want a bit of sort of help studying scores or any tips, of course I'm more than willing to help those who need it. But I've been putting most of my time into revising kind of work that I've done in the past. So you know, I've got lots and lots of arrangements and orchestrations which I've done over a period of 25 years in various states of sort of organization on my computer. So that's been a task that I've been putting off for years and years, you know.
And I suppose from a conductor's point of view, it's also a good time to be studying scores of repertoire you have on your hit list for the future.
It is, but you know, it's kind of difficult to sort of sit there staring at pages of music when you don't have any kind of sort of occasion to sort of play them, when you haven't got a date in front of you and you know it's going to happen. That said, what I have been doing is I've been listening to lots of pieces that I haven't heard before, and you know, I've got thousands of full scores in my flat here, and so I've been using them as a sort of roadmap, getting scores off the shelves that I haven't heard, and listening to them, listening to pieces for the first time. And it's great chance to explore the repertoire that you don't know at all.
Can you give me some examples? Because I'm curious to know where your intuition and your musical sensibilities are taking you these days.
Well, as I say, I've given myself a kind of set of, I've given myself a roadmap by going to the things that are on the shelf. So I've been, for instance, I've got the complete Walton on the shelf, everything that Walton ever wrote. And I thought I knew most of Walton, but of course I don't really know Troilus and Cressida.
Yes.
I don't really know the Bear. You know, I don't know the piano concerto, you know, Sinfonia Concertante, I didn't, and things like that, and then bits of Szymanowski, which I've had scores for, which I've never really got down to sort of to exploring in detail.
There's a composer, Szymanowski.
I never forget the first time I heard the fiddle concerto, the first violin concerto.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't speak for a fortnight. You know, so I guess a lot of it's exploring the fringes of composers whom I know and love and haven't really looked at some of the stuff in the sort of the outlying areas of their repertoire. And also, you know, publishers send me lots of scores of contemporary music, and it's never easy to get round to listening to them when you're working all the time. And I've now got this big pile of scores that I've had from shots and boozy and hawks and what have you, and I'm getting a chance to really look at them and enjoy them. And you know, there's some wonderful new music being written
That's
these days. I think it's in a very healthy
encouraging. Yes.
way. Yeah.
I mean, one of your challenges for the future, John, is to produce a performance or recording of Walton's Second Symphony that will actually beat the George Sell Cleveland
Impossible.
recording.
Impossible. I often direct people to that recording as an example of just how miraculous
It's
Zell and the
astonishing,
Cleveland Orchestra would
really
be. I think it
astonishing.
might be the greatest recorded performance of anything. That and the Partita, which he did at the same time.
Yeah.
And if, you know, people are sometimes very slightly sort of sniffy about Zell in that he was a perfectionist and stifled the kind of spontaneity in the quest for perfectionism. But you try and achieve that level of perfection that he gets in that recording of Walton too, and that's decades in the making,
Yeah,
in the building of that orchestra.
yes, he was a notoriously prickly and difficult man, but I heard some of the great live performances from him. In fact, you know, he died in the same week as John Barbirolli, and they were two of my real idols at that time.
They're still two of my idols,
Well, it's good to hear.
those two.
It's
You
good to
know,
hear.
you were saying about Zell being prickly, but I was listening to Myron Bloom, the horn player, being interviewed, and he said, "Oh, a lot of that is absolute nonsense." He said he was the greatest kind of hero of my entire life, and yes, he was a perfectionist, but he was tougher on himself than he was anyone else. It's just interesting to hear that from somebody who was there right in the thick of it.
One of the great anomalies with Zell was I heard him do the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra live with the Cleveland, and he always, throughout his career, made that hideous cut in the last movement, just into the coda of the last movement, and I could never understand, you know, that moment in the music where everything starts, is fragmented, and it starts gathering together. Its sonority for the final restatement of the theme, and I could never understand why he made it, particularly as he was a Hungarian. I mean, it just
Well,
extraordinary.
perhaps he knew Bartok, perhaps Bartok, I don't know. He must have had his reasons. I'm sure if he was around, he could have justified them. I wouldn't make the cut, but there you are.
Now, congratulations on your BBC Music Magazine Orchestral Record of the Year for the Cornguild Symphony
Why,
with
thank you.
your new relationship with the Sinfonia of London. I predict, in fact, would put money on it achieving the same accolade from Gramophone Magazine when the awards come around. They're in the judging stages at the moment. But it's an absolutely cracking performance of the symphony, and in fact the whole disc is cracking. Tell us, John, I mean, those of us of a certain age grew up with lots of movies where on the credits, particularly British movies, it was always the Symphony of London Orchestra, usually conducted by Muir Mathieson. You, like me, were hugely enthusiastic about that wonderful Barbirolli record of English string music. But apart from that, I mean, tell us your journey with the orchestra and how you've managed to acquire the title.
Well, you know, as far as records have existed in England, there's always been a kind of an orchestra on the go, which is made up of all of the kind of freelance players and principals from various orchestras. And if you go back right to the 1930s, you know, you'd have orchestras which had names made just for record labels, and it might be one of the regular orchestras under a different name or something like that. But when you get to the 1950s, the 55 this was, the British film industry was booming, and there were a couple of movies being made a week, and they all needed, especially in those days, they all had wall-to-wall music. And you know, it's been very sort of interesting sort of gathering information about Symphonia of London, because there isn't that much out there. But what I gather happened was, in the mid-50s, a lot of the players were freelancing, moonlighting, doing film sessions, taking time off from their regular orchestras. And one of the players in the LSO took some time off to do recording session. I think it was a clarinet player, and he got the sack. And I think 25 players from the LSO resigned in protest. And Gordon Walker, the principal flute at the time, formed Symphonia of London, which was meant to be a kind of crack team who could record an entire soundtrack for a movie in a couple of days. And he rounded up all of the best players, freelance players, principals from other orchestras, quartet players, chamber groups, and put them together. And between 1955 and 1964, they recorded the soundtrack for over 300 films, which was a, you know, a film a week. And of course, in those days, it was highly lucrative work, so he didn't have any trouble recruiting players. And they not only did film soundtracks, but they did recordings. They were the house orchestra for the World Record Club, and you know, Colin Davis made his first
Oh,
records of
yes.
Mozart symphonies with them, and
Yes.
then and all sorts of light music records. But the landmark record is the Barbarolli music for strings, and that was the first, totally coincidentally, the first LP that I ever bought. And I knew from the opening, I knew in the, almost in the silence before it happens, there's some magic in that Talis Fantasia,
Yeah,
that performance.
truly.
It still is the great performance of that work, I believe. And you can hear the rapport that Barbarolli has with these players. They're giving him everything he could dream of and more. And when I was 11 and I was a kid, and I knew nothing about music at all, but I knew that this record was special. It was the first LP. I've still got my LP that I bought all those years ago. And I'd often wondered what had happened to this orchestra, because I had a secondary connection with it, which was when I was a student. I was Howard Blake's assistant, and I used to help him out, put orchestras together for recordings for his movies and things like that. And I did know that in 1982, Howard Blake and Peter Willison, his orchestral manager, had acquired Symphonia of London. They bought the name from Eddie Walker, Gordon Walker's son, and they needed a named orchestra for the end credits of The Snowman. So if you watch The Snowman, and subsequent films that Howard did, you will see Symphonia of London. And then, of course, Peter Willison ran it as a going concern for a number of years, and it remained a kind of commercial outfit, recording movies and doing all sorts of pop records and things like that. And there's then a gap of about a decade or so, decade and a half, when it disappears. And I was having dinner with Ralph Cousins and Brian Pidgeon, who are great friends of mine. Ralph, obviously managing director of Shandos
Shandos,
Records,
yes.
and Brian Pidgeon, the producer. And we'd been recording, I think, one of the volumes of Richard Rodney Bennett. And my relationship with Shandos is such that we plan, as is their house style, series of composer-led discs. So we started with Copland, and then we're not even halfway through Richard Rodney Bennett's music, which is going to run to, I guess, 7 or 8 discs. A series of Eric Coates using definitive editions of the scores and things like that.
Okay.
But in amongst this, we were talking about repertoire that we wanted to make of music which didn't fit into any of these categories, so it wasn't part of a series, just a one-off disc of this and a one-off disc of that. And we got talking about, what would you really like to do? And I said, well, there are a couple of records that I've always felt I had to make, and the one that is most pressing is the Korngold Symphony in F sharp, because the way I see this piece, it's different to how pretty much everybody else sees it.
It's
I don't
also
see.
not quite what one might have expected Korngold's only symphony to sound like. It surprised me when I first heard it because I was weaned on, Die Totalstadt and the movie music and other bits and pieces. And it yes,
Well, a
it's
lot
not
of
what you
that piece
expect.
doesn't inhabit that world, and
No.
it's a much tougher piece, and it's much more austere. And the last thing I think that piece needs is chocolate sauce. It needs a really firm hand, and I felt passionately about how I feel this piece has to go. And whether you like what I do with it or not, I absolutely believe that this is how it goes, and it's a lot quicker than everybody else does it. But I did actually, after I'd made the record, I heard Korngold play it himself on the piano, and all of those tempo decisions that I made match up with his own kind of version, because he always favoured, even in his movie soundtracks, he favours a kind of forward tempo.
Yes.
You hear that sort of forward, sort of thrusting sweep in a lot of his music. Anyway,
What, yes. I mean, what is
I
electrifying about it as well, John, is the phrasal unanimity of the performance. I know that many of the string players you've worked with before, some in the John Wilson Orchestra, but I'm curious to know how you put the orchestra together and who
Right.
you reached out to.
Well, just to sort of to finish off that story, Ralph said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "That's the piece." And then we found ourselves with a very short window of opportunity to make this record. There was a week in January when I was free, Ralph was free, the venue was free, Brian, the producer, was free, and it was far too late in the day to use one of the orchestras we've been using for the other series of discs. So the conversation went in the direction of, well, why don't I just put together an orchestra? And it just, everything seemed to come together. I acquired the name from Peter Willison and Howard Blake. I started making the choices of personnel, and everybody was free, and we knew it was going to be fun because it was a room full of like-minded people, but it did exceed my wildest expectations of just how unified the kind of playing was. Now, to answer your question, there was a bit of overlap in the strings from the John Wilson Orchestra, but actually not so much. And I, all the wind, brass, percussion, harp, piano, everything is completely different people, but they are musicians I've worked with over a long period of time, and it was very much a collaboration in that I chose, say, for instance, the first trumpet, and then I said, who do you want in the section? Who can
Oh,
bring this and this to this orchestra? So it's been a collaboration building the thing. And we've got some wonderful solo kind of players in the winds, with Adam Walker on the flute and Alan Thomas on first trumpet. And I have got my great great friend Andrew Havron back in the saddle, leading the orchestra, which I think for me is the kind of the thing that makes it all possible,
Well,
because.
I want to come to his recording of the violin concerto in a moment, but yeah, that telepathy that makes great music making is clearly there in this performance. But you said something interesting when you were talking about the Barbarolli English string music record. You said almost in the silence before the music started, you knew it was going to be special. And I think one of the things that still fascinates me when I hear live music and I hear great conductors is that they kind of bring their own atmosphere with them. And there's a kind of strange understanding between them and their audience, and a way of creating atmosphere in any hall. I mean, Karajan used to take his own atmosphere with him all over the world, and you were on the edge of your seat before the music even started, which was a lot to do, of course, with his kind of his status and his autocracy, if you like. But yeah, I mean, that's black magic about making music. Is that something that still fascinates you?
Well, you did use the word I was going to say, which is the atmosphere. And what is great about that Barbarolli recording, and also his recordings of Delius, the famous Delius records he made with the Halle and the LSO, is there's an atmosphere surrounding those recordings, which is the essence of Barbarolli, the man himself. What I do try to do as a conductor is carry my sound
Yes.
around with me, which is, it's almost something I don't really feel comfortable talking about because, music is basically a doing thing and not a talking thing.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
since we are talking, I do have a kind of, my deepest musical creed is wrapped up with how an orchestra sounds. That's my first, highest, most overriding priority. And I've tried over the years to sort of almost make that a physical thing, so that when I'm standing in front of an orchestra, I'm sort of showing that sound and embodying that thing that I want the most. I'm not saying that I achieve it. But it's definitely why I do it.
It's funny, I've spent a lifetime writing about music, these things are so easy to recognize and so hard to define, which is why I absolutely sympathize when you say it's the sort of thing you don't want to talk about because it either happens or it doesn't. So it is one of the extraordinary things about music. But you kind of put your finger on it when you said you want to carry your sound with you, because I think conductors are identified very often by the kind of sound they encourage and make. The other thing
But
is
what I would just say, that just to interrupt, sorry, is, every orchestra that you visit as a guest conductor, that orchestra has its own sound. So half the kind of fun of it is working together, and how can the vision that I have of this piece and this sound that I want, how does that work with what you have? And every orchestra has its own personality, so it's the kind of fusion of these two personalities, which is where it becomes, where the thrill
Yes.
often is. And when I'm working with Sinfonia of London, which is kind of, for me, like looking in a mirror, because it's filled with people who share that kind of idea of sound that I have. So everybody is sort of gleefully up for the same, making the same kinds of sounds,
Yes.
which is, of course, the sky's the limit.
And also understanding the other key thing in music, interpretation, characterization, understanding the style of a particular composer or nationality.
Sure, and I said from the outset that I didn't want Sinfonia of London to have one particular style, but whatever style was appropriate for the music that was on the stand.
I love the recording of the Violin Concerto with Andrew Havran. I love it particularly because of its intimacy, and it's kind of that wonderful confidentiality, where you really feel as though it's kind of happening in the moment of creation. I always say melodies created in the playing of them, because it gives that improvisatory feeling, which I think is one of the key elements of that piece.
Well, it is, but have you seen it on the page? Because there's never a composer who's more prescriptive. Every last bit of rubato is
That's
written
interesting,
out.
isn't it?
And well, I think, and that's the key to understanding Korngold's sort of language. You do everything he asks for, and you do nothing more than that.
Right.
But it's like Massenet, you know. When I did Cendrillon at Glyndebourne last summer, every single bar of that 600-page score has an instruction or two in it, and the vocal parts are littered with instructions. And I realised very early on that the challenge for Massenet was to do everything that he asks for. And if you can get anywhere near everything he asks for, then you're winning. And it's the same with Korngold.
You're clearly a great lover of French music, and indeed, your last Symphony of London disc was of French music, Chabrier, Ibert. Escale, that piece that I first got to hear through that Jean Martinon recording many years ago. It's a terrific piece. I can see why that chimes with you. But French music in general, what is it about it that, I have problems with some French music, I'll admit. And I suppose my favourite French composer is apart from the obvious Ravel and the qualities there, is Poulenc, because I just love the variety of expression in his composition. But what is it about French music that works with you, for you?
Well, I mean, it goes back such a long way that I can barely remember. It was kind of love at first sight. But, as somebody who spent a lot of time putting notes down on paper, whether it be, attempting to be a composer when I was at college, which was something I wasn't interested in, but I did it for study purposes, having written many hundreds of arrangements and thousands of restorations of old film musicals, as you know. It's all of those great arrangers and orchestrators learned everything from the French. And if you think back to L'Après-Midi, what everybody else was doing when Debussy wrote that piece, he single-handedly created the modern orchestra as Berlioz had done before him, and as Ravel took it to the next level after that. And Dutilleux, a composer I absolutely revere, and the French have always had it. And it's interesting you mentioned that record we did, because when we were planning that record, the original plan was to make a record of lightish pieces which had sort of fallen through the cracks. And it started with a Spania, because one of the first LPs I had as a kid was Beecham. No, it was Carry-On. It was Carry-On. What am I talking about? It was called Philharmonia Promenade Pops, and it was Carry-On with the Philharmonia. And it was all sort of bits of light music. Carry-On famously said, "Light music is my medicine." And I was going to make a record along those lines, and as I was assembling the repertoire, it became apparent that a lot of it was French. And then I got the score of the Baron-Reiter L'Après-Midi edition, which is a really beautifully realised piece of scholarship, and I thought, actually, this is a piece I've done many, many times, and it's this kind of piece that changed the course of all music. And so I built a program with that Debussy in the middle of it, and everything surrounding it was in one way or another influenced by it. And I opened with a Chabrier, because there's another composer who was a maverick, but who had a serious kind of influence on so many of those French composers. And then, of course, the result is a mixture of things everybody knows, the L'Après-Midi and Ravel Rhapsody Espagnole and the Meditation from Thaïs. But then Ibert, Escale's a piece which doesn't get done anymore. The marvellous dances of Durufle, which were thrilling to play. The orchestra relished every bar of it. So I hope that in building the program as I did, it might breathe a bit of life into pieces which have really genuinely been forgotten.
Does French music require a word that always comes to mind when I hear things French is fastidious, and I suspect well I know you are because we've known each other some time, and when you talk about cooking, I know that you're fastidious. So do you think that's a fair characterization, John?
I often think when you're rehearsing and recording French music, you're basically stripping the engine down to its component parts, polishing every one of those component parts up till it sparkles, and then putting it back together. But what an opportunity is it is to sort of make an orchestra sound like $1 million, because all of those sort of techniques at the time, Ravel was pushing players to their limits, and now with all the marvelous players that we have and the limitless technical ability you have players these days, you have a vehicle to really, really show just how dazzling an orchestra can be. So yeah, it's marvelous fun playing French music.
Let's talk a little bit about the Richard Rodney Bennett series. It's been something of a revelation to me because I thought I knew quite a bit of his music, but I didn't know anything, as it turned out. I did meet him a couple of times. You were very, very good friends, I know. When I met him, it was fascinating because, and I heard him in cabaret, of course, singing and playing at the piano, but also accompanying jazz singers like Claire Martin and so on. I love the journey his composition took him on, and a journey of self-discovery, really. And that wonderful analogy he made of his career as being different rooms, albeit in the same house, and almost adding as a throwaway that he might have unceremoniously knocked down some of the walls between them, which I think is absolutely on the money. But for you, it's been a real labour of love, I know, because you were very close friends, and there are pieces here. I mean, on the latest disc, Aubade, for example,
Oh,
that
it's wonderful
isn't
music.
it just wonderful?
It's wonderful. You Richard did say that he felt that his sort of career was different rooms in the same house, and he may have occasionally knocked walls down, but I do also feel that towards the end of his life, there were rooms which he hadn't been in for a number of years. The door remained closed. And these are the doors that I'm opening when we're recording this music, because I knew Richard very well. He was one of my closest friends, and during the last bit of his life, I knew him for 15, 20 years, but he was interested pretty much only in playing the piano, singing, playing the piano for singers. And he wrote music only occasionally. And there is this great body of work from the late 50s, right through to the 80s, which he almost stopped talking about. And there are many reasons as to why he stopped discussing his kind of concert music. That he wrestled with the language for a long time, that he eventually reconciled in his Third Symphony. And I think he felt that the level of expectation on him as a youngster was more than he could handle. He was openly talked about as being the next Benjamin Britten. And he achieved incredible success very early on, writing operas, that were played at La Scala when he was in his 20s, and the LSO premiere in his First Symphony, Bernstein in the New York Phil premiere, the Second Symphony. This was very high profile career. And I think it all got a bit too much for him. And he closed some of those doors. And what I'm doing, and it really is a revelation, is going through his entire catalogue and recording these pieces which really are in the sort of canon of 20th century British music. They have real significance. and it's time. I can't think of a composer whose music needs to be rediscovered as urgently as Richard's does.
Yeah, well, keep them coming, I say. I know you're enjoying conducting opera, John, and in fact, when lockdown was announced, you were in the middle of Turn of the Screw at Wilton's Music Hall, which was a very enticing prospect, not just in terms of the piece,
Yeah,
which we all love, but the venue.
and a great cast and a fantastic band, and we'd been rehearsing for 5 weeks, and
Oh,
then we
Lord.
had the down tools.
Oh, just. I mean, do you feel as I do? Because, you know, both of us are musical theatre enthusiasts of all kinds, but that it's a shame that barriers have to be put up between different kinds of music theatre. That, you know, one still separates opera from musicals and so on and so forth.
I don't know who gains from it in the long run, because you know the discipline that you need to sing Carousel is the same kind of discipline you need to sing Carmen. I mean, of course the style is different, and yes, you have to have special training to deliver an aria by sort of Puccini, but you have to have equally special training to be able to sing the soliloquy from Carousel. And I think, you know, there needs to be much more of a dialogue in the sort of between the institutions that train people for musical theatre on the one hand and opera on the other, because there could be some wonderful cross-fertilisation between the two camps.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. When all this kicked off, I presume you had a prom in place this year, and was it another compilation prom? Because, of course, that information has never reached us.
And it's not going to either, because if I were to have been doing a prom this year, I would hope that it would be carried over into next year. But that's if I were doing a prom. So we will just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Are there any pieces in the musical theatre literature that you would love to see revived seriously?
Yeah,
Tell
there
me.
are. I mean, where do I start? I would love to have a go at The Most Happy Fella, because I think there's so much to get your hands on there, and there's so much to sing, and it's brilliantly scored, and that could do with a kind of, you know, I don't know how you get people to come to a piece that nobody knows these days. That's the only problem. But wouldn't it be marvellous to see something like that at the English National Opera or something, you know?
Well, I mean, there are companies that, you know, the country opera companies could crack a piece like that. In fact, I think Most Happy Fellow was certainly on the shortlist a couple of times for Glyndebourne.
Oh, really?
Oh
I didn't know.
yes, there were one or two people who talked about it when I was making podcasts for Glyndebourne.
It's got
And
some great roles for you know real singers in
oh,
there.
hasn't it just?
I think I'd like to see She Loves Me. I think it's an absolute
That's a little
cracker.
masterpiece, isn't it? I think it's Bockenheim's best piece.
You know, it was going to be made into a musical with Julie Andrews at MGM, and they pulled the plug on it because musicals weren't making enough money by then. I think it was 63 or 64, I can't remember. Maybe
Oh,
later than that.
perfect for her, eh?
And they cancelled it. Because that film was never made, I think that's why that piece isn't like a household name piece.
It's very interesting, the paradox of Frank Lesser, though, that one of the shows I did on Stage and Screen at Radio 3 was a program with Joe Sullivan and his second wife. And she, of course, was in Most Happy Fella. But she said the thing he kept hankering after time and again was he hated singerly. What he would call singerly kind of singing. And, you know, he was so, because his lyrics and music are so entwined,
Well,
that
that's
he
what
would
I
have.
meant when I was talking about cross-fertilization between
Exactly,
the two art
exactly.
forms, because one can learn so much from the other. You know, I was
And
listening to
yet he wrote music that needed to be sung as well. You know, that's
And it's
fascinating.
very, very, very difficult thing to deliver a conversational lyric in with a real voice. You know, that's it's almost a sort of kind of oil and water combination. You want the lyric to be sort of intimate and conversational, but then you've got to project to the back of the gallery as you did in those days before microphones. So it's a kind of a unique challenge.
I had a conversation once with wonderful Dawn Upshaw when she was in her prime and making her Rodgers and Hart album. And I said to her, you know, well, what is the key here to projecting the style? And she said, it's all about understanding the vernacular of the lyric. She said, if you get the vernacular across, the voice will follow. And she said, I don't use a different voice. I just drop the center of gravity a bit. She said, it's and I've always remembered that. And
It's
it's
interesting. Bernstein divided musicals into two camps. On the one, American musicals, and on the other hand, operetta. So for him, The King and I and My Fair Lady were operettas. West Side Story and Guys and Dolls were American musicals because they used the vernacular.
Yeah,
That was
it's
his
clever.
dividing
Yes,
line.
yes, yes. And I think Previn did the same thing, didn't he? He always referred to My Fair Lady as one of the waltz operettas, almost. You know, he did that world
Yeah. Well, it's the
of
kind of summit of that world, isn't it, really?
absolutely. Well, look, John, it's a pleasure, and I hope. I mean, how are we going to get back into? Obviously, we're all hoping for a vaccine for this thing and treatments, but otherwise, it's very hard to see how social distancing can be married to people having a good time in an auditorium.
It is, as I said earlier, we have to hope for the best. In the meantime, we have to be inventive and come up with solutions for more intimate forms of music making. You know, I've been looking at things that I've got in my library, which I've written arrangements for sort of 20 players, which are. It's a chance to explore. I'm trying to stay positive. We're all trying to stay positive through all of this, and I'm seeing a chance to try and explore some of the smaller scale pieces that I've not had a chance to do because they haven't fitted into the kind of regular schedule of orchestral life.
Yes.
But please God that before too long, there's a cure to fix all of this so we can all, in all walks of life, get back to normal.
Well, thanks, John. Everything's crossed.
Thanks, Ed. I'm glad this all works.
Yeah, great.
Take
See you
care,
soon.
man.
Bye.
Cheers.